Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. We're in depth with special coverage of this historic election. You know the results. Now for the next 2 hours, the reasons voters made the choices that they did and what that means for the incoming president, for Congress, and for us as Americans. Now, here's what I'd like to hear from you. I know this is raw this morning if your candidate did not prevail, but I'd like you to think about this. I'd like to know who you think we are as we emerge from this election season. Did this election change us as Americans somehow? This is the topic of my Friday roundtable this week, and I'd love it if you guided some of my thinking on this. Where are we on the other side of election 2016? Who are we? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. Steph Curtis in the conversation at nprnews.org/live. I'm on Twitter at Carrie NPR. We have numerous guests this morning on issues, voter trends, unexpected results. Also want to let you know that we are awaiting a press conference from Hillary Clinton, supposed to happen sometime around 9:30 a.m. our time. And when that happens, we'll go live to listen in to her remarks. We're starting with Catherine Rampell. She's an opinion columnist at The Washington Post and with us from Washington. Catherine, welcome back to the show. Good to have you here.
Good to be here.
Erica Bernal Martinez is with us. She's Deputy Executive Director of NALEO, the National Association of Latino Elected and Appointed Officials, and she's with us today from Los Angeles. Erica, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Thank you so much. Good morning.
Erica, how would you answer that question that I'm putting to our listeners, many of whom are calling, to tell me what they think? What would your answer be?
Sure. I think looking at the upset from last night, I can say that we are a deeply divided country and that there's going to be some soul searching happening, I think, all across the country, across all sorts of stakeholders, and really looking at how this election was so misread, but also how we pave a path forward, how now President-elect Trump needs to be the leader for all Americans and the diverse Americans that live across this country. And that's going to be quite a task. And I think everyone's going to be trying to figure out how that happens.
Catherine, as Erica notes, we knew we were divided. What did we not know about those divisions that we learned last night?
I think we didn't realize quite how many people had found solace and appeal in Donald Trump's message of Make America Great Again. For months, of course, he had been behind in almost every poll. Large swaths of the American electorate said that he was unqualified to be president, had expressed concerns about his behaviors, about his treatment of women, about his comments about minorities. And when it came down to the polls, though, whatever concerns those voters may have had, they were clearly not sufficient to sway them towards voting for anyone else. So just the sheer level of popularity, defying all of the polls, I think, is one thing that came as a surprise and perhaps a learning experience out of yesterday's results.
A call here from Laura in Eden Prairie. Hi, Laura. What did you learn about who we are yesterday in this election?
Well, I guess I learned what everybody else did, that we are deeply divided. My thoughts have always been that Trump does represent a sea change, and people are so worn out with the established political situation. Unfortunately, I think he's a Trojan horse. I don't think he's going to do half of what he said he would. I don't think he can. And I don't think he necessarily believes a lot of what he said. He was very pro-life once upon a time. Pro-choice once upon a time. And, you know, turned pro-life for convenience. And I'm certainly a progressive, but I'm a fiscal conservative, as okay. I think actually many progressives are. And I hope this unleashes the sort of groundswell that was unleashed in the Tea Party on the right
okay.
now in that.
Laura, I have a lot of people who want to get in on this. I'm going to stop you there, but I'm going to come to you, Catherine, on something Laura suggests, which is Did voters give Donald Trump, the people that supported him and elected him president, a clear sense of how they want him to govern? Did you hear that and what voters are saying?
Well, Trump's campaign has really been more about affect and attitude, what it means for America to be great, what it means to have power in the world, to feel strong, to feel rich, than nitty-gritty policy details. He obviously has released some policies, including tax cuts, for example, but they have never really been the focus of this campaign. And even those that are, you know, clearly policies, things like building the wall, mass deporting, some number, a changing number of undocumented workers who are here, even those, he's never really been eager to get into the policies or the feasibility of the plans that he proposes.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that when voters, I mean, I can't obviously speak for the millions who voted for him directly, what was going through their heads. But my guess is that when voters were casting their ballots for him, they weren't necessarily thinking of a particular agenda, mm-hmm. or even subset of an agenda that they expect him to undertake, so much as we need a strong guy there. I like his vision. And I believe he's going to get tough on a lot of problems, and I'll sort of leave the details to him.
Erica, I think what Catherine is saying provides a lot of free rein for President-elect Trump, but it also could be potentially dangerous for him, too.
I would absolutely agree. I think that, again, the difference between running for office and actually having to govern and bring a nation together that has suffered a deep divide is a tremendous challenge. And I think I would argue that for our organization, while this is certainly the headline of the morning, I don't want to lose sight of the fact that there was a swell in turnout of Latino voters, and we saw tremendous victories down ballot where a lot of ceilings were broken. The first Dominican American with an immigrant background elected to Congress from New York, the first Puerto Rican elected from Central Florida to Congress, as well as Catherine Nesto, the first Latina elected to the U.S. Senate. And so there is lots of work to be done, but I also think that, you know, in an era where we have seen gridlock in Congress, so much of the difficult policy work has gone to the states and local communities where elected officials are really leading on so many different issues, climate change, transportation. And I think that some of that work will continue to happen. And so that I want to believe there's a silver lining on that front as we figure out as a nation how we're going to move forward.
You know, Erica, I'm glad you brought this up because this is something I've been a little confused about. Donald Trump, in the end, actually did better than Mitt Romney did in 2012 among Hispanic voters. Now, it was, you know, it was overwhelmed by the Democratic candidates in both of those elections. But Trump actually increased the percentage from 27% to 29%. How do we explain that? Clearly voting on some different issues.
Right. And you know, and exit polling always has its challenges. And I think we have to do some much deeper analysis of the results over the next few weeks and the coming months. But it goes to show you the incredible diversity of the Latino community and that it can't be pegged. And I think what this shows moving forward is that no candidate, Democrats or Republicans, can afford to take the Latino vote for granted. And while we saw, again, an increase in a swell of Latino participation, we have to look deeper at the numbers to see, you know, how investments made into turning them out and reaching them actually translated into support for either candidate.
Erica Bernal Martinez is with us this morning. If you've tuned in, she's Deputy Executive Director of the National Association of Latino Elected and Appointed Officials with us from L.A. And Catherine Rampell with us. She's an opinion columnist at The Washington Post, pulling in a lot of perspectives and ideas and dimensions from our different guests this morning for the next 2 hours as we dig a little bit beneath the surface of the election results last night for president and down ballot, as we talk about voter trends, who turned out, who didn't, what that meant, what that means for the agenda of the incoming Congress and the incoming new president. And I'm asking you, as you think about this, even if your candidate for president prevailed or not last night, I'd like you to think about who we are as we emerge from this election season. Did the election change us? Did it tell us something about ourselves. And I'm going to ask you not to go to the easy place. Yeah, we're all racist or we're all misogynist. I'd like you to do a little more soul searching on that. What does this tell us about who we are beyond the fact that we're divided? We know that. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828 on Twitter. At Carrie NPR, Mike says the election didn't change us. Rather, it heralded changes already in place that the so-called experts couldn't or wouldn't see. From another listener, I'm despondent, feel like we're headed back to 1950 at best, or worst, the 1930s. Hate has been given license again. And to the phones to Josephine in Lakeshore. Hey, Josephine, welcome, and thanks so much for waiting.
Hi, thanks.
What are you thinking about today?
Who are we as a people? I think the Christian voters really came out, and their voice is going to be heard about the abortion issue, and at the very least, stop the taxpayer funding for abortion, and, you know, hopefully maybe get it to the states.
That was a key issue for you, it sounds like.
Oh, definitely. And yeah. I think that business owners are encouraged. I think we can trust Trump to put in place good people, you know, honest people that are going to encourage business, bring business back to America. I think he will be just in his dealings with the illegal immigrants, that yes, we encourage immigrants to come here legally.
Okay.
And encourage people to work.
All right.
Get back into the workforce.
Josephine, I appreciate the call very much. To Alex in White Bear Lake. Hey, Alex. Hi. Thank you for waiting.
Of course. Thanks for having me on, Carrie. So I'd like to say I'm a progressive millennial.
Okay.
And back during the primaries, I supported Bernie Sanders. And I know a lot of people my age and of my persuasion did as well. However, because of what happened during those primaries and what I will call various types of rigging through whether it's media bias or last-minute closing of polling stations, we just couldn't bring ourselves to vote for Hillary Clinton. And I know a lot of people my age and of my persuasion did vote third party.
Wow.
I feel like that had a huge impact. And what you asked and what this says about us as a people, I feel as we are fed up with what I would call the establishment, with people like Hillary Clinton thinking they could just become anointed and that they deserve the presidency. I feel as though we as Americans are saying no to that fact.
Erica, what are you hearing what Alex just told us?
Yeah, you know, Alex, you bring up a great point. I actually have been doing some thinking about this overnight and do think that one of the analyses that needs to be done is how the Clinton coalition that she needed to actually win, whether it came together or not, and which segments of that coalition, millennials certainly being one of them, Latinos being one of them, African-Americans being another, whether those folks showed up in the numbers that she needed to actually carry her over the finish line. And so lots of questions and analysis that needs to be done. But I think the caller we just had certainly brings up a critical element of whether that segment of the electorate that she needed to win turned out
and so
voted for her.
Yeah. And when Erica earlier, a few minutes ago, you said we saw surges in Latino voters, but did they reach the number? Were they as key of a part of that coalition as they needed to be?
You know, I think we need to look at the numbers. I would suspect that in places like Nevada and Colorado, Latino voters probably helped really provide that over the hill bump that she needed, where we saw her carry those states. And I think that, again, just looking at some down ballot victories for Latino candidates that broke some firsts in their races, I do think that they showed up. It's a question of whether proportionally other segments of the electorate also increased their voter turnout. And
right.
So we saw really a political calculation that no one had made because of the nature of this electorate that actually turned out in this election.
Catherine, I was listening to NPR this morning. There was kind of an interesting back and forth about what we're just talking about here between Steve Inskeep and John Feary, a Republican strategist and I think pollster. Listen to how this went and the issue around these coalitions that Hillary Clinton needed.
I am reminded of something that we heard in 2012 from a Mitt Romney advisor who said, this 2012 is going to be the last time that anybody ever tries to win an election with a white-only coalition because the country is changing so much. Does it appear that Donald Trump has actually, 4 years later, done that?
You know, I would say that actually Trump did better amongst Hispanics than Romney did and did better amongst African-Americans than Romney did. It wasn't really just an all-white electorate. Now, that being said, he did go for that white middle class or white working class in a way that Romney never could. And he excited voters that never voted before in ways that by taking really and taking the Democratic position on a lot of issues like trade and other economics.
And we should be.
Catherine, those economic issues, I know that that was your beat at the Times, and I know you know a lot about that. Where do you see that really being important to what happened?
To how people voted,
yes.
Or what would happen under President Trump?
No. To how people voted, the coalition.
Well, it does seem as if more disaffected voters, those who have potentially struggled more with economic stagnation, wage stagnation, were motivated by Trump's message to drain the swamp and throw the bums out and try for something different. I would note that in the last year or so, the U.S. economy has shown tremendous amounts of growth. Last year alone, we saw the single largest median household income increase on record, going back, I think, something like 50 or 60 years. And so it did appear that some positive changes in the last couple of years would potentially allay those concerns about economic stagnation and encourage people to vote for basically an extension of Obama's legacy, you know, that his policies were working, maybe belatedly, but they were working. And clearly from the results that we saw yesterday, that's just not true, that there are a lot of people who, you know, who knows exactly what was forefront on their minds, mm-hmm. but a lot of them, given the rhetoric in this campaign, a lot of them expressed concern about the American economy's place in the world, about their own pocketbook, about who could actually make them rich again. You know, a lot of voters have spoken about putting their trust in Donald Trump's ability to turn the economy around because he is a lifelong businessman rather than a politician.
And, right. I think we heard that from Josephine. Yeah.
Yes. And that that experience could potentially be put to good use in the White House. And therefore, you know, he's the right choice. I should note that markets so far do not seem to have agreed with that. We saw huge plunges in futures markets last night. Number of markets opened way down today, which suggests that traders and investors do not agree. And I think Trump has some assurances to make to markets. I mean, Larry Kudlow actually was last night or earlier this morning on CNBC urging Trump to call in and to remind people listening, traders listening, that he would be good for the economy. Here's what his policies are. This is a good thing that he had this surprise upset. But a lot of economists who have actually looked at Trump's plans, and they may evolve, have suggested that they could actually be quite bad for the economy and for many working class Americans, you know, having a trade war and so on. But you know, Americans don't trust experts anymore. So, and that was pretty clear with how they voted yesterday.
I think I'm in trouble if Americans don't trust experts anymore, because that's basically my career here. But I guess I'll deal with that on another day. Catherine, thank you. Thanks very much. Good to have you.
Thank you.
Catherine Rampell is an opinion writer at The Washington Post. Autumn says on Twitter that we are racist and misogynist is not the easy answer and, in fact, is the elephant in the room you need to talk about. Autumn, what I really meant was I wanted more than just a call that says, and so now we know we're racist. I want you to do a little more soul searching. Tell me a little bit more about how you think about race and gender in this. Whitey says, I think last night wasn't a mandate for Trump, but a message of nihilism to the establishment of the two major parties. And Steph, off the page.
Mike says, the best thing about the historic, humiliating defeat by Hillary is that it opens a door for a likable person to become the first female president. Amy Klobuchar would beat Trump. And Twin Cities Chick says, if I said exactly who I think we are as a country, you wouldn't be able to say it on the air.
Erica, back, I mean, and Catherine said this at the beginning, too, that this was so much more about personality, attitude, affect than it was about policy. But a president has to govern with policy, too. Where does that leave us?
It leaves us with a lot of work to do.
And a lot of questions, because, right?
A lot of questions. And I think, you know, as an organization whose mission as a nonprofit organization is to empower Latinos to become civically engaged and have a voice in the political system, we hope that President-elect Trump truly does open the door to hearing from the diverse stakeholders across America and the folks who've been working hard on many, many issues and really have committed to make America stronger. And I would reference again that in recent years where Congress has been gridlocked on so many issues, tremendous policy work has happened at the state level and local communities on such critical issues affecting our country, from transportation to housing to climate change. That will certainly continue. And I think we all, again, through this soul searching, are going to have to figure out how we continue to move forward.
Erica, really a pleasure. Thanks so much for getting up early in L.A., although it sounds like you had somewhat of a sleepless night. So
that's right. Thank you so much
all
for
right.
having me.
It's really good to
Bye-bye.
Talk to you. Erica Bernal Martinez, Deputy Executive Director of NALEO, the National Association of Latino Elected and Appointed Officials. I just want to come back to the phones. I want to open up some of the phone lines here and let you have your say this morning. So we're going to take just a couple minutes. I'm going to go through some calls. I'm going to start with Shauna in Mound. Hi, Shauna. How are you thinking about this today?
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
You know, I just wanted to comment on the feeling that this election cycle was really a rejection of establishment politics. We're hearing a lot about Donald Trump being an outsider, and
yeah.
that's what made him so appealing. But I couldn't help but notice as I was watching the election last night, so many incumbent Republicans were winning. So to me, it felt like a little bit of hypocrisy in that we wanted to bring in an outsider, but yet we were re-electing kind of the status quo. And I guess I was curious what you guys had to say about that.
I've made a note on what you had to say. It's a really good point, and I'll ask our upcoming guests on that. I mean, the interesting thing about this, Shauna, is that Donald Trump not only took down Democrats, but he was at war with his own party. So. You know, how does he end up working with a Republican-led Congress?
No, and I completely agree. And I think to that point, I have to wonder, was the tenor of the election about the establishment, or was it more about the liberal left changing the look and feel of the country? And so mm-hmm. I think Donald Trump, again, he spoke a lot to that in a lot of the hateful and racist things that he's talked about. And so I think kind of across the board, he was tapping into so much. But I think the thing that stood out to me more was a lot of the incumbents were
right.
maintaining their seats. And so how is that going to be? How are we really going to see the change, you know, if that's the case?
It's a good point. I've made a note. And as our upcoming guests come on, we'll ask them about that. Thank you. To the phones, to Lance in Redwood Falls. Hi, Lance. Tell me what you're thinking this morning.
Well, I am a farmer, small business owner in southwest Minnesota. A lot of what has happened in this election I feel very good about, because I had to drop out of the health and care system a year ago because my rates went up to a point where I couldn't afford to make the premium payments anymore.
Mm-hmm.
We have a lot of environmental stuff coming down on us, the waters of the U.S. A lot of this is all driven by politics and not by fact and science. And so I feel like a lot of that is going to be slowed down tremendously with what's happened here. I've also seen a lot of support from the Blacks, Latinos, the gays, women that are being suppressed. As I go through the areas I go through on the internet, there was so much suppression of those people from those factions that actually are very strong supporters of Trump.
Okay.
So I feel like that hopefully will be good now, and people will see him for who he really is and supporting all of them.
I appreciate your views, Lance. Thanks for waiting to share them. And to Eva, listening in Stillwater. Hi, Eva. Thanks so much for hanging on.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah. What are you thinking today?
I feel like this election for me personally has really pulled the veil away from something that, as a woman, I've experienced my whole life, that is misogyny, that, you know, it's not like it's anything new. It's not like it's anything that is surprising. For me, was that it was such a that it was so public, and yet I feel like the resounding answer when we ask the country, "Are you willing to accept this in your president?" The answer was yes, and so I feel really fearful, and I think the same can be said with bigotry, you know, hate crimes against other communities. I feel like there was some validation, and I was really hopeful that even that we could kind of even go beyond party lines and say we're not going to accept that kind of speech from our leader. And so I'm just feeling a little bit disheartened. And my daughter is due. I have a teenage daughter, and the look on her face was pretty hard to take this morning.
Yeah, you've put this, Eva, I'm really glad for the call because you've put this in an interesting way. Are we willing to accept the allegations that Trump denied, but that were pretty overwhelming? Are we willing to accept that in a president? And enough voters said yes. That's something I'll talk to our guests coming up about it. Thanks so much for the call. It's a conversation this morning taking note of what voters said in the presidential election and all these down ballot races yesterday, and then what they really meant, and then what that means for the incoming president-elect and Congress, and what it means, I think most importantly, for who we are as American citizens, as an American union here. This is a bigger philosophical question that I've been thinking about through the election, and I don't think contemplation of that ends here now that the election is over. So I'd love to have you think about that a bit, call in. Who are we on the other side of this election? It's something that we'll be talking about in the Friday roundtable. Definitely wanted to give you a chance to weigh in, bringing two new voices into the conversation. Now, Chris Nichols is with us. He's director of Citizenship and Crisis Project at Oregon State University, where he's also a professor. And Christopher, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me.
And Van Newkirk is with us. He covers politics and policy at The Atlantic and with us from Washington. And Van, welcome to you. It's good to have you back on the show.
Thanks for having me again.
Van, I want to bring something to you because a caller just brought it up. She said maybe what we're hearing from voters is that they did not like the way the liberal left is changing the look and the feel of the country. What do you think of that?
I think that's actually a pretty fair assessment of what happened and what we saw last night. I think what really we've seen maybe in some of the polls, some of the exit polls, was a real refutation of this idea of America as a sort of diversifying identity project. And mm-hmm. I think people, when Trump says make America great again, you think about what the idea of when America was great means. And that's a very homogenous sort of place, not just racially or gender-wise, but in terms of where people live, the nuclear family, how they lived. And I think maybe that's what voters, at least the majority of, not the majority of voters, but the majority of the Electoral College votes wanted.
Christopher, what do you think?
Well, I think that that's about right, and I think your caller did hit the nail on the head there. You know, I've been struggling to come up with some historical comparisons, and this is really an anomaly. It's astonishing. You know, it reminds me a little bit of the homogeneity of the early Cold War and the kind of Red Scare and a coming together against external threats. But in terms of the electoral shift here, I mean, the thing that stands out to me is the magnitude of the GOP's down-ballot victories.
Right.
I mean, it was just stunning. And this is also unprecedented. The majority of state houses controlled, governorships, you know, Senate, Congress, and the presidency, likely the Supreme Court. I mean, this is as dramatic as everybody is feeling this morning.
Chris, here's a question that comes to my mind about this, which is, Donald Trump spoke in very broad brush kind of ways about policy. Do voters know how they want him to govern? Does he know how voters want him to govern?
Well, I suspect he believes that he has a mandate to govern from the gut. So we know of a handful of things that he's said he's likely to do. You know, he's said that he wants to immediately start a process of a border wall and border security. We know he wants to deport undocumented folks. We know he wants to tear up trade deals. We know he wants to immediately convene Congress and try to repeal Obamacare. And to the extent to which he can pull those things off, you know, where it's uncertain. But that's what I think he believes he has a mandate to do. On the other hand, it's pretty clear that, you know, while the those of us in sort of the establishment were taking him, not taking him particularly seriously in every way, and this is reminiscent of a comment that was made in the Atlantic. His voters weren't taking him literally, right? So we don't really know if it's a what the specific policy proposals he wants to do were things that his voters were in favor of.
Van, do you think that's right?
Yeah. So I think what that article points to is that voters were looking for a doctrine and not necessarily a specific policy position or set of policy positions. I think the doctrine indicates that Trump has a praxis, a way of dealing with problems that appeals to people, and doesn't necessarily tell you specifically how he's going to deal with each individual problem, but we know that Trump will use sort of aggression, strongman tactics. He's going to be a new type of political figure. And that's the doctrine. And I think people were looking for, apparently, someone who could put a voice to their anxiety in a way that made them feel safe and comfortable.
The other thing, though, that comes to mind, Van, is there's going to be, you know, the restlessness and the impatience is still simmering there, I would guess. And
oh, yeah.
He's going to have to deliver on something and before I think we see this kind of erupt again. It won't take long.
I believe so. I think really what we're looking at, especially when we're talking about middle America, we're talking about the people who have been, who are losing jobs, who have been poisoned in West Virginia and Rivers. One of the things I think that's going to come back to bite Trump very soon is his absolute failure to deal with the environment, because that's actually impacting a lot of people in what he calls coal country, mm-hmm. What he calls the middle America right now.
And Christopher, what he said about that is we've got too many regulations and he's going to roll back some of those executive orders that President Obama signed on that.
Yeah, and he certainly can. I mean, that's the power of the so-called imperial presidency these days, is that through executive orders, a lot of governing is going on, and a new president, especially with a likely, at least largely pliant Republican Congress, he's going to be able to do that. I do think the piece to add there, though, I think the environment is exactly right. I'm not sure that voters care very much about that. I think as a sort of inversion of 2008, we're sort of seeing an anti-Clintonian, it's the economy stupid kind of moment. I mean, the exit polls clearly showed that people thought trade was the one of their main issues and that trade, you know, cost jobs. I mean, now, such as we can trust exit polls, and I think we should take them with a lot of skepticism today, it's this anti-globalization sort of sentiment. And I wonder how he'll be able to create jobs. I mean, he's made promises there, and the economy's doing fairly well, but
that's
he's
right.
talking about more industrial jobs, manufacturing jobs.
He's actually put numbers, you know, in a rare moment of specificity, he's actually put numbers to how many jobs that he said he would create. So Cal says the discussion is all about rational reasons for voting. I think emotion was a major element. Trump met people's emotional desire. John says, after the Republican Party stomped on the ACA, the EPA, and Roe v. Wade, what will they do to make America great? One wonders. John Tao says on Twitter, simply put, the election results have elicited a deep fear for many like me. And Steph off the page.
And someone writing anonymously says, are you going to talk about the urban versus non-urban voting patterns? So many liberals say they value diversity. Doesn't last night's election demonstrate a diversity of opinion? I think it's time for urban citizens to connect with rural citizens and to really understand why they voted the way they did. They're not awful people, but they have different lives and different priorities.
Okay, Steph, let's go back to Christopher and Van on that. Christopher, what would you say to that?
Well, the urban-rural divide is one that political scientists have been talking about for several generations now. Actually, really, it goes back to, you know, FDR and the New Deal coalition of the 30s, except in a sort of an inverse kind of formulation where you had white working-class folks supporting Democrats. So I don't know that there's going to be a way to bridge that, because if you think about the issues that rural voters versus urban voters are voting on, largely they don't see eye to eye. And this is what your great question about, you know, what does America mean today, signify. I think there's a real divide, a fundamental sort of cultural values divide between rural and urban voters. You can see this in all sorts of issues, from First Amendment, Second Amendment kinds of questions, all the way down the line.
Yeah, and I, Van, I think we saw that our writer on the page here is getting at something that we saw in a lot of the ways the Electoral College votes ended up, right? You'd see these big turnouts, and there'd be this area of blue in a state like Pennsylvania, and then there'd be all surrounded by red, right, in some of the more rural areas. How do you see it?
Right. I think that's so, as a person from a rural place in North Carolina, this connects with me pretty deeply, the idea, and this is something that we have been trying to figure out for a couple election cycles, is how to think about and how to talk about what rural voters actually want, how to poll them. And we've seen actually sort of their importance magnify as the power of America shifts from the Rust Belt to the Sun Belt, as it moves south, as it moves to more sparsely populated counties. And I really think what we're looking at is almost a complete rethinking of how we look at politics, polls, and public opinion.
You know, Van, I just want to bring this up before we go back to the phones. I was reading something that Ron Brownstein wrote in The Atlantic, specifically on what you've just said about the Rust Belt and the Sun Belt. And he wrote, now this is before the results, if Trump does as well as seems possible in the Rust Belt, and he did, by the way, and Clinton still defeats him with big gains in the Sun Belt, which she did not, this may be remembered as the fast-forward election that compressed into a single cycle those demographic and geographic changes that most people expected to unfold over a decade or more. Those changes are probably still coming, aren't they? They just aren't as compressed as Mr. Brownstein thought they might be.
Well, the demography's already there.
Right.
And the problem with that, and we've seen it in North Carolina and Florida and Georgia and lots of states after Shelby County versus Holder, and maybe lots of states moving forward as we get more challenges to the VRA and Supreme Court, is it takes quite a bit of policy to actually put and mobilize those diverse voices, people who have not participated in the electoral process heavily before, in play.
Call here from Michael in New Prague. Michael, thanks so much for waiting. I know it's been a while. Wanted to get to you, though. What are you thinking?
Hi. I just want to say that I'm kind of a young guy. I'm 18, mm-hmm. you know, and I voted for Trump last night mm-hmm. For many reasons, and some of the reasons immigration. I come from an immigrant mother, actually. She's from Colombia, mm-hmm. and actually I live in a rural kind of place in Minnesota, and I work actually at Green Giant, and I work with many, many, many Mexicans because they come up here during the summer to work for
right.
harvest, like 400, and you know, to a lot of people's surprise, they actually really like Donald Trump because, well, for number one, well, they have to be legal, but they feel that, you know, they're going to get stolen if Obama, you know, let all these legal immigrants become legal, you know, because they waited so long to become legal here, and they're very proud of that.
So Michael, just understand that. So the people with documents to come up and work on these guest worker or migrant worker opportunities did not like the idea of Hillary Clinton's immigration plan because they thought that they were here legally. They thought people were going to be brought into the system that hadn't done the legal work that they did.
Yeah, and I mean, that's just from my, because I mean, I talked to many, many, I was actually in charge of a lot of them, actually. They went down to Texas again.
Okay.
Season's over. But that's one reason. The second reason is he talks about building a wall. I mean, I don't know. I'm kind of divided on that, but They like that idea because, I mean, the reason they, like, left Mexico, some of them, you know, is because of the violence there,
uh-huh.
you know, and the turmoil. And they understand that that could spill over our border, you know, unless we have some type of border security, you know.
Yeah. Michael, here's what I want to know from you, since you supported Trump. How much do you care that Trump actually does build a wall a real wall. Does that matter to you in the end?
I mean, I believe that. I mean, maybe not literally a physical, giant, beautiful wall, as you would say. But, I mean, yeah, I think we need better security on there because a lot of them tell me stories, too, of how bad it is down there. I mean, some of them actually have, you know, ranches on the border, and they tell me how illegals are crossing there, and occasionally they've seen armed government running drugs over the border. You know, no one talks about this, but I talked to a lot of them, actually, about it.
Okay.
And it's mind-blowing that no one's really looking at it, you know, and it's happening now. He says there's a war going on. I mean, it's not really a full-blown war, but, I mean, it's a serious problem, and, you know, a lot of the people up here, they don't really understand. They just kind of see it as, like, hey, you know, Trump doesn't like Mexicans because he wants to keep them out. You know, that's not really how it is. It's just that there's a problem down there.
Okay.
I mean,
Yeah, Michael, I appreciate the call. You've given us some stuff to talk about. Christopher, just to note this, that there are more people going back to Mexico than are coming to Mexico illegally. We've got a reverse migration going on here. But to what you heard our caller saying about the specific promises around immigration that Donald Trump made and how he hears that.
Right. He tapped into a deep vein of sensitivity across the American public. I mean, the Pew Research Center had some fantastic polling on this all year in April and in May, indicating that there's a huge threat perception that Americans feel about undocumented immigrants, and in particular, to underscore this point in another way, the possibility of terrorism creeping across America's borders. And so I think, you know, that caller is probably exactly right in the way that other types of Trump supporters are thinking. They don't care so much maybe about the physical wall, but rather about the perception and the reality of whether or not people are coming into the country who might be a threat both to jobs but also to security.
Van, I think this is what maybe journalists like us never got, which is the perception doesn't necessarily match the fact, and that doesn't matter.
Right. Like you said, you know, we have a net onshoring of jobs. We have a net migration to Mexico. These things that are sort of facts, empirical facts that we can prove via data, just don't match up with perhaps the individual narratives of places that Trump appeals to. Maybe it looks different on a border town or for people working in coal mines in West Virginia than it does on the whole. And also, I think the narrative of fear is just so effective. And we, I think, underestimate how good Donald Trump is at selling sort of narratives.
Van Newkirk with us from The Atlantic, Christopher Nichols with us from Oregon State University, and special coverage as you tune in this morning. Maybe you found a couple minutes to listen to us talk about what happened with the election, what voters are saying, what that means for the agenda of the president-elect and Congress. And I'm asking you this morning to think about whether your candidate for president prevailed or not last night. I want to know who you think we are on the other side of this historic vote. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. Steph, off the page.
Frank says, what does this election say about us? That most voters are completely knowledgeable with regards to government. Trump has as much chance of getting things passed as Obama because the people that should have been voted out of office, the ones responsible for the do-nothing Congress, have been reelected.
Christopher, I think that's saying a lot of incumbents were reelected to Congress. And that's true, isn't it?
Exactly. Incumbents held seats. Most Republicans, just the beginning of the 2016 election cycle, assumed were lost. I mean, it's a really astonishing shift.
It makes no sense. I mean, it's a vote for change at the top and then a vote for keep it as it is, you know, down the ballot.
Right. And so we need a lot more information here. But one thing that was coming out from the exit polling and other data was that, you know, maybe there was a coattails effect for Trump in some ways, that the people who were coming out and voting for him actually were also voting for other Republicans. And then on the other hand, we got some exit poll data that was interesting that said that, you know, among some of the voters for Trump, something like 18% of them thought he wasn't qualified, and yet 20% of them who felt that way still voted for him.
What does that say to you? I mean, draw something from that, because that really puzzles me.
It, it puzzles me too. I think it's when I've been doing, you know, panels about citizenship in the U.S. and whether or not we're in a moment of crisis, a lot of people have just expressed to me that they want change. And I think that more than any other element here is what's at work, the affect, the emotion, the fear, even the rational question about qualifications or not, that all subsides. And people want change more than anything else.
Call here from Zach in Moorhead. Hi, Zach. Were you one of those voters that wanted change or what? What were you thinking about?
No, I was actually hoping to protect what Obama's done. But what I would like to talk about is kind of what you guys are saying with the facts. And I guess I feel like I listen to a lot of NPR. I try to listen to other sources that are reliable. And what I get out of the information is just seems like something totally different than what people on the other side of the aisle are getting. And I've tried very, very hard to understand where people are coming from supporting Trump. They make arguments like Hillary's a liar, but you constantly see and hear videos of Trump contradicting himself, like on a daily basis or within even one conversation. And I guess I've tried very hard to understand where the other side's coming from, and I can't seem to do it. And then the other side seems like they're trying from conversations I've had to understand where I'm coming from, and they can't seem to do it. And so I just wonder, as a country, where do we go from here when we have two sides that just completely can't even understand.
We're talking past each other. Van, it's a good point.
Yeah, and I also think there's one thing we really can't ignore when we're talking about sort of the perception threat among the surprising Trump numbers here is racial threat and also misogyny. Those are real things. And when we're talking about a candidate who is only sort of big policy proposals have been to implement stop and frisk, to eliminate Roe v. Wade, to eliminate to roll back even more parts of the Voting Rights Act, to eliminate Obamacare coverage that for 20 million Americans who were the most vulnerable people and also tended to be people of color. Mm-hmm. Those are things that, you know, we cannot ignore in this analysis. And that's looking past people, but also sort of this retrograde thinking that, you know, I think a lot of pollsters miss because we thought we were in a different place.
Yeah, Christopher, what's interesting is as we take stock of what voters were really saying, the results of this is this perception that those 8 years of President Obama, in the time that he was in office, first that election was meaningful, and then in the 8 years that he's been in election, the diversity of this country has only increased, and that somehow this election was going to tap into it, and it's done the opposite, which makes me say, is that time still, are we still on the horizon of having that diversity really express itself in an election? Somebody said to me last night, is this the last gasp of people that aren't comfortable with that change? Or maybe it's not. How do you think about it?
Right. I mean, in the 2000s, there were a lot of studies of this, the so-called coming Democratic majority, where, you know, 10 years in, and that demographic change has happened. And every major pollster, you know, Sam Wong and the Princeton election group, you know, had a 99% chance for Hillary Clinton to win, largely based on state-by-state polls and demography.
Right.
You know, so how long will that be? You know, where does that, you know, how can we predict the future of that? It's hard to say. I mean, the demographic trends are clear, and you know, they are obvious. It's obvious that they'll have a major impact on the electorate, both at the state level and local level and at the national level. But that's what's so amazing about this election, that the down ballot victories by the GOP, I mean, you know, if you go, Democrats have suffered a devastating loss at all levels of government.
That's right.
in this cycle, right? And you look to the state houses, you look to governors, those are really the laboratories of democracy. And that's where what Ben was talking about, too. You're going to see these sorts of proposals, tax cuts, smaller government. You can look to states like Kansas to see, you know, to see the strength strengths and weaknesses of these kinds of policies. They disproportionately hurt minority groups and low-income folks. But I think so the question of change and how that's manifested in terms of these demographics is also interesting because it gets at age, which we haven't talked about yet. You know, and it's a little bit reminiscent of the Brexit vote. In that, you know, the majority of people 45 and over in this country voted for Trump, and the majority of people under 45 voted for Hillary Clinton. Huh. And the basic distinction there is that millennials have almost the exact same voting power as boomers now in our society.
They
and
don't
yet they do
exercise
not show up.
It. Yeah.
Right?
And I talk to students
all the time about this.
These millennials are going to be mad at me because I was talking about this yesterday on Twitter. Are you voting? Well, yeah, you know, blasting me back on Twitter. Yes, we're voting, but the numbers tell the tale. Christopher, really good to talk to you again. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me on.
Van, a real pleasure to have you on the show this morning. I know you're super busy trying to write stuff on this, so thank you.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Van Newkirk covers politics and policy at The Atlantic. Look for what he's going to be writing about this today. And Christopher Nichols with us, associate professor at Oregon State University. Still awaiting news of when Hillary Clinton will make remarks. Apparently very long lines at the venue at which she's going to make these remarks, and so trying to get people in the room, and President Obama due to say something about the election at 11:15 our time. We'll bring it all to you when it happens. Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News, and this is special coverage of the election results. You know the results by now. For the next hour, the reasons that voters made the choices they did, what that means for the incoming president, for Congress, and for us as Americans. And I've been asking you through the last hour, I want you to continue to think about this, whether your candidate for president prevailed or not, who are we on the other side of this election? Who are we as American citizens, as an imperfect union, as President Obama talks about? This is what the subject of my Friday roundtable is going to be this week, and I'd love it if you'd guide my thinking. Continue to do that, because I'm getting some great thoughts from you so far. So think about that. Who are we on the other side of this election? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828 on Twitter at Carrie NPR. And I'm looking for some thoughts beyond, well, we're clearly divided. I think we know that. Go a little deeper than that and share your thoughts with me. Also, Steph Curtis hanging out at nprnews.org/live. Our guest this hour, Mary Kate Carey, is with us, contributing editor for U.S. News and World Report and a former White House speechwriter in Charlottesville, Virginia. Mary Kate, really good to have you back on the show. Welcome.
Oh, thanks for having me, Carrie.
Jason Johnson is with us, politics editor at TheRoot.com and a professor at Morgan State University in Miami. Jason, long time no chat. Really good to have you on the show.
Glad to be here.
Well, Jason, who are we after this election, beyond divided? We know that now, I think.
We are a nation of relatively underachieving and very resentful white people. And that's the majority.
Okay.
I mean, that's
That's not the majority, though. I mean, we're diversifying very quickly, Jason. So what do you mean?
Well, what I mean by that is the country is defined by who we choose as the president, right? We're saying this is the person who represents our hopes, our dreams, and our aspirations. And Donald Trump was elected by a large coalition of not working class, uneducated college people, but he created a coalition almost exclusively of white Americans. And that is a coalition that is different from the demographic changes in this country.
That's right.
And that is a coalition that he galvanized by basically promising to recreate a sort of mythical white state of the past. And that's a disturbing future for certain segments of this country. And clearly, Hillary Clinton won the popular vote, so that's not what the majority of the country wants. But that's the majority of the country that was in the Electoral College. So that's who we are right now. We are a nation that wants to be represented by a man who says, I want to make America great for a select group of people. And if that's at the expense of others, so be it.
Mary Kate, what would you say to that?
I would have a little different take on it. The maps that I've seen county by county across the country are just a sea of red, and it's very surprising to me the different types of people who voted in unpredictable ways last night. I've been in many of these sort of talking head things where usually my, you know, person I'm debating with on the left, for a long time, their whole mantra was that demographics are destiny and that the Republican Party, you know, has no future because the demographics just aren't there. And to me, that was a really not arrogant, but taking people's vote for granted based on their demographic profile, to me, is very unfair and not a thoughtful way to go through life. And so I believe in sort of the battle of ideas and that people don't vote automatically based on their gender or their ethnicity or their age or whatever. They vote for their own enlightened self-interest, as the founders would say.
Yeah.
And so I think this is a fascinating change in all of that, and we're still going to be sifting through who voted for who, when, and I think it's absolutely fascinating.
Jason, I like what Mary Kate says about the battle for ideas. I'm not sure that's what this election represented.
Yeah, it wasn't. Let's be clear. I'm not on the left. I'm an academic and a scholar, and I'm an expert in sort of campaign communication. Donald Trump said and ran on a campaign of directly blaming immigration, people of color, and othering everybody and saying, I'm going to make America great for a certain kind of white person. That is what he said consistently. And he got elected that way. Now, if you're going to make an argument that that is somehow radically different from how America has operated, well, we can make that argument one way or another. But this was not a campaign about ideas. This was not a campaign about resumes. This wasn't even a campaign about change. This was a campaign about retribution and retaliation and resentment against what was perceived to be a change in how America functioned, both demographically and culturally, under Barack Obama. That's what this boiled down to, because there's no way that anyone could fundamentally say that Donald Trump won a battle of ideas. Donald Trump didn't have very clear ideas. And we can criticize Hillary Clinton for having ideas that were unpopular.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't say that Trump's ideas beat her out because he didn't express any.
Mary Kate,
oh, I would have
ahead.
To disagree with that.
Yeah.
So I used to work at the RNC. Obviously, I was a speechwriter for a Republican president. And I would be considered a traditional establishment Republican to the Trump crowd. And when you look at the fault line within the Republican Party over ideas like immigration, free trade, entitlement reforms, all the different things, you know, foreign policy, all the things where he broke with Republican orthodoxy to the point where many Republicans did not vote for him strictly because of the fact that he doesn't present himself as a Republican. There's a good argument that he's a Democrat. And so to the people on the right side of the aisle, this was a huge battle of ideas. You can talk to John Kasich about it, or Jeb Bush, Paul Ryan. They all have substantial policy differences with Donald Trump. So I would disagree and say this was very much a battle of ideas, at least on our side of the aisle. And I think you could say that there were substantial policy differences between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. And there was another whole debate on that side. So I disagree with you. I do think that you're right. There were some emotional, very emotional moments during this campaign. But to say that there was no ideas or no arguments for change, I really have to disagree with you. I think this was very much a change election.
Hey, Jason, do you have time for a caller here, or do you have to run?
Sure.
Okay.
No, I can do a couple more minutes.
Let me grab
more.
Catherine
okay.
in Rochester. Hi, Catherine. Thanks so much for waiting.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to say that as a mother and a physician, I feel profoundly disappointed in the choice of the American people from the standpoint of what it means to be a human,
mm-hmm.
and that we would let change trump everything else, including common human decency, and endorse rhetorics of hate, division, intolerance, misogyny, racism. And it is just, it strikes me to the very core. And I think that as Americans, we need to wrestle with this, that we have put change above all these other things.
Catherine, I appreciate the call. I'm going to go to Julian in St. Paul. Hey, Julian, thanks so much for waiting.
Yeah, hey, Jason. I'm African-American myself, and I'd have to, you know, just speak out on this a little bit and let you know. I believe Hillary Clinton took for granted the minority vote. She, you know, she thought that we would forget about her mass incarcerations of African Americans, her super predator comment, and you know, believes that we forgot. We don't forget things like that. Maybe it is time for change. Like Trump said, I didn't vote for Trump. I voted for Bernie. But like Trump said, what do we have to lose? I mean, do we look forward to the same thing? Do we believe what people say during their campaigns and then trust that they're going to continue? It's always the same.
Jason, what would you say to Julian there?
Well, there's a couple of things. Number one, I think it's very important if we look at the numbers. Now, mind you, the exit polls before this campaign were wrong, so I look at the post, you know, exit polls with a grain of salt as well. This doesn't have anything to do with black or brown voters. This was about white people. This was about the fact that Hillary Clinton may actually have gotten fewer white voters than Barack Obama did, and he only got 38% in 2012. So the notion that this election fell to a lack of African-American or a lack of Latino turnout, that is actually just practically and functionally not true. And you must also take into consideration this is the first American election in 50 years without the Voting Rights Act, and you have specific instances of voter suppression specifically targeted at black and Latino voters in Ohio, in Pennsylvania, in North Carolina. So you can't just say, well, people didn't turn out because they weren't enthusiastic. It's hard to turn out when you only have one voting location for an entire county, which is what they did in Ohio. That's the first thing. The second thing is this, and I'll be very clear about what's at stake. I think that there were plenty of Republicans who were running who were perfectly qualified. I think there's plenty of Democrats who were running who were perfectly qualified. I've talked about that throughout the entire year. But what we're looking at is a candidate who the public actually doesn't know that much about, who has absolutely no government experience, and whose very election caused the stock market to drop by 800 points. This is the kind of man that we have elected as president of the United States. There will be consequences. When we talk about issues of criminal justice, he wants to make Rudy Giuliani the attorney general, someone who says that we should have national stop and frisk. This is someone who's made it very clear that he will have no interest in addressing those kinds of issues. This is someone who's made it very clear that he will tear up both international security and economic treaties if they're inconvenient to him. This is a danger to global security. And so there's a lot that Americans have to lose right now. I think we're going to experience all of those things relatively quickly if these economic indicators are going to be sustainable. And I don't have a great deal of optimism. But again, this is how democracy works. We'll live with it, or maybe we won't. But this is the man who's been elected president of the United States.
Jason, I really appreciate the time and the views.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you. Jason Johnson is politics editor at TheRoot.com. Mary Kate, we're awaiting an interview here with Governor Dayton, governor of Minnesota, but I'd love to have your thoughts on Jason's ideas there. And I may interrupt if we get the governor, if that's okay.
Sure. I can tell Jason's very upset.
I think a lot of people are. What was your first clue there?
Yes. But here's where I sort of took hope, and I am not a big fan of Donald Trump's. I am, you know, Republican, but I certainly disagreed with a lot of the things that went on in this campaign. But I thought his remarks last night, you know, when he accepted Hillary Clinton's phone call and then came out and talked to his supporters, are continuing kind of a trend of him really doing a lot better in the last few weeks. I wish it had started in July after he got the nomination.
Uh-huh.
But the fact that he's been sort of using a teleprompter, sticking to the message, not attacking, you know, Miss Universe or Gold Star families, the fact that his campaign took away his Twitter feed, I think was brilliant. And I think last night, some of his language about, you know, the stuff that's getting quoted is that, you know, he wants all Americans to come together and he'll be the president of all of America. But when he said the forgotten people will no longer be forgotten, and then a few minutes later thanked the Secret Service agents and the police officers who had protected him, that to me spoke to the millions of people out there who have felt forgotten and who never get thanked. And I thought that's the nail on the head right there. And I think that's what Hillary Clinton missed in all of this. And her the biggest mistake she made was saying the basket of deplorables and all the irredeemable people. And I think that's what stuck in people's heads. And I think that explains a lot of what propelled Trump to victory.
Mary Kate, I totally defer to you. You have much greater political knowledge than I do. But when I hear you go down through that list of Gold Star families and he's thanking police officers, well, she did all. I mean, she had a Gold Star family, you know, begin this this debate at the convention,
right, which was
and campaigned
brilliant.
For your and I just I mean he seems to have come to this so late and it doesn't seem to have mattered.
I think if I was in charge, if it could have started in July, I think he would have done a lot better through the end of the summer. The fact that he started turning the corner in just in the last 2 or 3 weeks of the election. But I think that's what we're seeing, and I'm hoping, you know, I might be naive, but I'm hoping that's what he's going to be going forward, and that will be reassuring to people. It certainly reassured a lot of Republicans who were on the fence at the last minute. I think a lot of the late deciders went for that.
So this is interesting, because you're saying that there were voters that could be persuaded, that were just waiting to see him act and in a more dignified, potentially presidential way, and he fulfilled that in the last couple of weeks.
That's what I was hearing from my undecided friends. I was getting phone calls from people because everybody went nuts with the Billy Bush tape and said that, you know, oh, my God, you know, how do we handle this guy?
Right.
But then once that sort of faded into the background, they said, actually, he's doing all right, you know, and he made a good last pitch at the end there and talked about change. And I think people said, you know what, I think he's going to be all right. But who knows? He could go off the rails again 3 weeks from now. Let's hope not.
Hey, I want to ask you about something because House Speaker Paul Ryan is speaking right now. He's saying that the House majority is larger than he thought it was going to be. Can you imagine what this working relationship is like between President-elect Trump and Ryan for however long he ends up in that position?
Well, there's been a lot of speculation in the last week or so whether Ryan would stay on as Speaker of the House by his choice, or if Trump were to win, which obviously now he has, if Trump were to sort of engineer some kind of coup. But the good thing that happened last night, there was a phone call between the two of them. Ryan's spokesman came out and said it was actually a very positive and productive conversation. In Trump's remarks last night, nobody's reporting this. He said the first issues that he's going to start working on right away are inner cities, infrastructure, taking care of veterans, and growing the economy.
Hmm.
He did not say building a wall, kicking out Muslims, any of the controversial stuff. The fact that he led with inner cities said to me that was an olive branch to Paul Ryan, because Paul Ryan's top priority is lowering the level of poverty
That's
in
right.
this country.
Yeah.
And so I took that to mean if he could find common ground with Paul Ryan right off the bat, that would be a really smart thing to do. And start getting a couple, you know, in baseball talk, get a couple singles and doubles going before he goes for the big stuff like repealing Obamacare, changing the Supreme Court, all the stuff that's going to be hot button for the left. If he can find stuff that everybody agrees on, I mean, who doesn't agree that we need to fix income inequality or poverty in our inner cities or taking care of our veterans? That's where both sides, not just Paul Ryan, but the Democrats as well, could really come together. And I thought that was very interesting that Donald Trump said that last night. But nobody seems to have picked up on it in the press.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned this. Paul Ryan's saying right now that Donald Trump heard voices other people weren't hearing, which I think confirms what you've just said. Andrew mm-hmm. says on Twitter, I think the rural unemployed want money and jobs more than reacting to social issues. Steph, mm-hmm. off the page.
Someone anonymous mm-hmm. says, we had a split vote in my household, so there were some family hugs and inquiries asking if family members were okay this morning. We're thinking about Rodney King today and wondering why we can't just all get along. Peace out.
Okay. And to let you know, it does, I'm watching CNN in the studio here, it does look like Hillary Clinton is arriving shortly at this venue where she is going to make some remarks and deliver her concession speech. So, again, we'll interrupt the ever-patient Mary Kate Carey here when she gets there. I'll bring in Philip Chen here for a moment. Philip, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Hi, glad to be here.
A PhD fellow in the political science department at the University of Calgary. I know you heard what Mary Kate just said, and I'm really glad she brought it up because I missed that in Trump's speech. What do you think of that?
I think that she's right that the rhetoric that Donald Trump was using in his speech was, I think, trying to reach across that aisle. Though I might push back on. I do think that Democrats and Republicans can agree that income inequality and taking care of our veterans and our crumbling infrastructure are important issues. The question, of course, will come to can they agree on the means to accomplish those things.
And Mary Kate, yeah, that's the big question, right? I think they have potentially different views of how to get that done.
Yeah, that is exactly right. That's sort of speech writing 101. You know, I'm a speech writer. You always start with, okay, here's the ends that we all agree on, and let me persuade you why my means are the best ways to get there.
Uh-huh.
And so that's going to be the challenge for each side, is to say, here's the common ground, and follow me this way and follow those guys that way, and we'll get to the middle, you know.
Philip, there was a lot of analysis that, including in a front-page Time story, that says, well, we also shouldn't ignore the fact that this is a repudiation of 8 years of President Obama. Is it?
I'm not convinced of that. I think that we've seen that partisan division and partisan polarization in our country is quite wide. And a repudiation, I don't think, would look like a one presidential candidate, President-elect Trump, winning the Electoral College vote and the popular vote being split and possibly winning, being won by Hillary Clinton.
Yeah.
I don't think that's necessarily a repudiation of the existing administration, of the Obama administration, in the sense that Hillary Clinton essentially represents an extension of the Obama administration. And roughly 48% of the country said, yes, we'd like to continue that in some way, shape or form.
What do you think, Mary Kate?
The numbers I just saw, you know, as of the last hour, I think they're still counting votes. Is that she's only ahead by 0.1% of the popular vote. So certainly not a wide margin like you saw in, say, you know, 2000 or 2004. But I would argue, too, that it was more of a repudiation of Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton as sort of the embodiment of the New York, Washington elite. And that has caused... over the years, the Clintons' domination of the Democratic Party has led to the lack of a bench in any way for them across the country. The number of state legislature types, you know, congressmen, senators, pales in comparison to what the Republicans have. This is why the Republicans had 17 people running for president, you know. I think it's because the Clintons have so dominated the Democratic Party for so long that I think that same wave of anti-elitism that hit the Republicans earlier has now hit the Democrats as well.
Philip, I want to ask you about something that we talked about at the very beginning here at 9 o'clock with some other guests, which is there has been a lot of speculation about whether voters of color will fulfill their voting potential. You know, will they turn out in the numbers the so-called Obama coalition that Hillary Clinton needed? That includes, you know, men and women of African-American background. That includes Asian voters. What kind of numbers are you seeing that gives you whether it's an answer to that or not?
You know, I haven't seen exact of all of the exit polling numbers, but what I have seen suggests that Latino and Latina voters turned out at higher rates than we may necessarily have expected, given sort of past performance. And again, there was some struggles to turn out the African-American vote. But again, this is if we're looking at trying to explain how Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton did last night, we have to look more broadly at issues of class as well as issues of race in order to start to understand what is in fact going on with a fairly evenly split country.
Yeah. Mary Kate?
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that was a lot of what went on last night was socioeconomic class as well. And I just, as I was saying earlier, I just don't think any voter should be taken for granted. I think there should be a battle for every vote, and no one should be presumed to be voting some way because of the boxes they check off on a piece of paper in terms of their demographic profile. I agree.
I just want to bring in a caller here from Melissa in St. Cloud. Hey, Melissa, how do you see the results and what that says about us?
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sure.
I'm a liberal progressive who voted for Hillary, and I'm surprisingly calm this morning about this election. I think, first of all, I think he's primarily an entertainer more than a politician. I'm not too concerned that he can enact, you know, anything based on his racism and sexism. I don't think we're going to have apartheid or anything like that. So that's a little bit helpful. But beyond that, I know a lot of neighbors who voted for him who are not racist and not sexist, and I think there's a level of excitement about the idea that he could achieve what he achieved basically without the backing of either party. I mean, he was the Republican nominee, but many Republicans agree he's not really a Republican.
Yeah, and Mary Kate just said that. Yeah.
So the idea that he could do, and I think that's the same excitement that fueled Bernie's run. I think the idea that someone could have ideas that don't conform to party, shtick, and that they don't kowtow to what the party tells them to say, and they run as a person is exciting. Now, he's not a very appealing person to me, but I think that the fact that he got where he got means that someone else could get there next season without having to kowtow, and that's kind of exciting.
Yeah, so Melissa, really well said there. And Mary Kate, that was some of the analysis I was reading this morning. Like, don't read too much into some kind of permanence around what brought Trump to office, right? There's still a lot of roiling and a lot of change simmering, and who knows what this brings next time.
Yeah, I agree. I think, and I agree, Melissa, that was really well said. The idea that he was able to do this, breaking just about every rule in the playbook in terms of holding these massive rallies. He didn't have a ground operation like Hillary Clinton did. He got a lot of free media. He didn't spend money on ads. He was not a traditional conservative Republican. This means, I think, going forward, that says to our far right wing of the party that you can be a moderate Republican or a liberal Republican even and get elected president of the United States. And so I just think that there's so many taboos that he broke. It's fascinating to me what do you do next time? Does the next person running for president spend a lot of money on a ground operation?
Oh my gosh. Philip,
you know, interesting question.
This is exactly, and when people would say, well, how do you think this is going to turn out? I'd go to the ground. I thought that really, really mattered. Apparently it doesn't.
No. I mean,
yeah.
Or ask an ad exec. I mean, he barely spent money on advertising.
Right.
You know?
That's right.
Yeah, I think that you're hitting on something important, which is if we look at where the bulk of Trump's support came from, it seems to have been he turned out rural voters more than I think anyone really thought that he would. That's a demographic, and by dint of their geography, that is not particularly well suited to a ground game the way that Hillary Clinton used a ground game to turn out people in cities and suburbs. And so he may have sort of stumbled on or intentionally found a way forward for a party that maybe as we increasingly geographically sort, is not able to rely on a really intense ground game to turn out voters, because it just simply isn't feasible to knock on that many rural doors to turn people out.
And when Philip, when you say we geographically sort, you're talking about the book The Big Sort and how it looks like we are moving into areas with neighbors and a community that more reflect our own views.
Yes, to some extent. And there are admittedly some
exceptions.
Methodological critiques of the Big Sort. But the idea being that if you look at where liberals are congregating, it tends to be in cities, it tends to be on the coasts. And if you look at where conservatives are congregating, it tends to be in suburbs and then in rural areas. And again, this is, you know, whether or not we believe that people are moving in order to be around like-minded people, or it's simply a function of policy preferences and amenities, those are not things that we need to debate. The fact of the matter is it's easier to use a ground game to turn out people who live in densely populated cities than it is to use a ground game to turn out people who live in rural areas.
Jim says on Twitter, hopeful that people previously defending the two-party system now see the urgent need for something better. Steph off the page.
Zach Sperry says, I think this election leaves the Republican Party with a lot to prove. They control our government now so they can deliver on all the change they say Obama has been holding back. It would be good to see politicians stop blaming and start taking responsibility.
Mary Kate, GOP with something to prove.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. They don't have the excuse of divided government, which was, I think, what most people thought would happen would be there'd be a lot of ticket splitters, and we'd have Hillary Clinton in the White House and the Republicans on Capitol Hill with more gridlock. And so this takes that out of the equation. And I think the Republicans have no excuse for not presenting a positive alternative to the last 8 years and getting the country moving again. It would be shocking to me if they don't do that. They've got the biggest opportunity they've had in decades.
I want to say here that vice presidential candidate Tim Kaine is now speaking to the people that have assembled to hear Hillary Clinton's concession speech. He's making some remarks and then assuming that he will introduce her. And when she comes up to speak, we'll go live to listen in to what she has to say. I'll take a call here from Paul in Shakopee. Paul, forgive me if I have to interrupt you, but thank you so much for waiting, and I want to hear what you have to say.
Basically, I think that the majority of this election wasn't even about who we were voting for. It was who we were voting against. The only part that I think we were voting for is to say, stop with politics as usual. We're sick and tired of nothing getting done. And most of the friends that I know didn't like either of the candidates, myself included. Mm. Personally, for my vote, I ended up voting for Johnson just because I was hoping we could get a third-party system in for the future.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm just really irritated with that everybody got caught up in all the rhetoric and all the BS with the stupid comments about, you know, what that Trump made about women, or all the email stuff with Hillary. The majority of the people that I know believe that all politicians are pretty much crooked anyways, and so Hillary was par for the course. And as far as Trump, well, he didn't have any experience, didn't know anything, and it was maybe a way with his rambling on and his anger that maybe they were trying to place somebody in there who would get riled up enough and maybe be more of a blue-collar voice, I guess, or something along that lines, but that's kind of where I'm at. So.
Yeah, no, Paul, it's really good to hear your view. Philip, I think Paul's articulated where a lot of voters were last night.
Yeah, I think that's true. If you look at a lot of the exit polls, I mean, we've known this for the entire campaign cycle, we have two major party candidates who are more disliked than any major party candidates in history. And so, yes, there was absolutely sort of this idea that, well, maybe I'm voting against Hillary Clinton. Maybe I'm voting against Donald Trump. But I think I'd be remiss if I didn't point out that what we saw last night really does underscore the importance of partisan identification in the American electorate.
Well, how so?
When we look at it, we see that right around 90% of Democrats voted for Hillary Clinton and mm-hmm. around 90% of Republicans voted for Donald Trump. These are numbers that are roughly in line with what we have historically seen for maybe a little bit low, but not massive. You know, we're not talking about 80, 70%. People are not defecting from their parties to vote across party lines for the president. And this is not a new development, but a relatively new development in the last maybe 30 years as partisanship has hardened in the American electorate. Yeah. And so I think even if you may have said, well, I don't like Donald Trump, I don't like Hillary Clinton, the reasons you may have not liked Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton might have been partially because of the rhetoric that they used or the decisions they made. But it's also because we are expressively we believe in our parties, and we are in some sense psychologically predisposed to dislike the other side when we have these really hardened partisan identities.
So, Mary-Kate, this is what you were saying earlier, which is essentially that Republicans found enough ease with Trump to come home to him. Because wasn't that the big question, whether they would just sit it out?
Right, right. That's exactly right. And I have gotten, you know, texts and emails this morning from other Republicans and, you know, just political friends. The amount of chatter about going forward, that there's really, it's kind of absurd to a lot of people why we aren't more of a multi-party system and why our third parties can't seem to get off the ground at these elections and poll such, you know, Johnson and Stein polling so small a share. And I do think that the fringes tend to call the shots a lot. And I think there's a big, you know, there's a 20% on the far right and there's a 20% on the far left. And then there's this 60% in the middle that doesn't feel like the political parties are speaking for them. And I think if you had a fiscally conservative, socially tolerant, middle ground independent party,
mm-hmm.
would clean up.
Really?
I really do.
Huh.
It's too late for this election, but maybe in the future.
So that's where you, I mean, that's, you know, independents have been hoping for that, and we've had our experience with that, Mary Kate, and it just never seems to really take hold.
Yeah, it's, I don't know if it's a money problem or if it's, there's no infrastructure, there's no, you know, way to get on the ballot in 50 states. But boy, that would be a really fascinating thing to be involved with, I think.
Oscar says on Twitter, remember Jesse Ventura. This feels a lot like that. I cover Jesse Ventura. Yes, I remember him quite well. Ashley says, name the whiteness on the air. Name it. She says, be bold enough to read my tweets on air or you are part of the problem. She is saying this is it was white voters
mm-hmm.
who stood up and supported Trump. And that's absolutely right. The numbers support that. Steph, off the page.
And Jane says, you must address the role misogyny played in this election. That is the pink elephant in the living room and all the knee-jerk hate against her. People just don't want to claim it. Claim it now.
Okay. Mary-Kate and Philip, thank you so much.